Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Alad Davies about his new book, The City of London and Social Democracy, The Political Economy of Finance in Post-War Britain. Alad, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Mark.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
So I'm a historian of Britain in the 20th century, and I'm interested in kind of economic policy and politics right throughout the 20th century, I suppose, but mostly focused on the post-war period. This book we're going to talk about is the product of my PhD research, which I completed in 2014 at the University of Oxford. And I now, after working for the last 3 years while writing up the book at the University of Bristol in the UK, I now have just started a job teaching at the University of Cambridge.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks.
What led you to select this as a topic for your thesis and your first book?
So I think what really motivated me was the financial crisis drew my attention to the politics of finance and of the City of London. So I became interested in the question of why Britain has this huge financial sector and how it has come to be so dominant within British politics at the end of the 20th century and today. And I sort of wanted to understand a little bit how the city fitted within the overall story of Britain in the 20th century and to explain perhaps, though I'm not really sure I've got there quite yet, to try and explain perhaps how something of the something about the financial crisis and Britain's role within that. It's very much motivated by contemporary political and economic questions, at least in the first instance. And then as a historian, of course, you end up being pushed backwards in time, because even though this is, you know, relatively contemporary history going up until the end of the 1970s, you really are constrained by source material and getting in archives and stuff. So I think that's going to be a long project for me going over the next few years, really working up to the present, perhaps, and thinking about how what I wrote about in this book, which looks at sort of the 1960s and 1970s, how that leads forward into the 1980s and Thatcherism, through into sort of the politics of Britain in the 90s and early 2000s. So hopefully I'll be working on this for some time to come, really.
You really do capture in this book a very critical period, and it's something that you explain early on. On the one hand, you have the city, which as a financial, as a, for lack of a better word, an industry, has been part of Britain for centuries. It's a for those listeners who might be a little unfamiliar, it's sort of the British equivalent of Wall Street or the Bourse, and in Paris. And so you have this section of London which has been a critical component of the British economy going back to the 18th century and even earlier. But when you open your book in 1945, as you explained, the British economy is balanced very differently than it would be for people who are familiar with it today. And I was wondering if you could explain what that balance was and what the city's role was within the British economy in 1945 and the 1950s.
Sure. Well, I suppose the first thing to do is I'm going to knock us back into the end of the 19th century and say that the City of London, like you say, it's a term for the financial sector in general, like Wall Street would be in the US. But if you go back to the end of the 19th century, the City of London was at the center of the first age of globalization. You know, the world banking system was based in London. Capital, money flowed around, was exported around the world from London. Trade was settled in London. It really was a truly global financial centre. And this dominance was fatally, well, very severely destroyed, damaged by the First World War, when the break with the liberal international trading order was destroyed, and the city sort of attempted to hold on to an international, a global role, right through the 1920s and 1930s, eventually resting on an area of countries who used sterling, but really it's sort of global dominance was slowly was undermined, and we say transfer over to Wall Street and New York. By the end of the Second World War, the city's international role is really, really constrained and really damaged. So you have this internationally oriented financial sector that is really limited in what it can do. But after the end of the Second World War, a Labour government in the UK is elected on the promise and with the idea of developing a sort of national industrial economy that can overcome the weaknesses and the failures of the interwar period of high unemployment, but also can provide a way for Britain to achieve some form of economic success. So the focus is on really production of industrial products for sale abroad. And in this context, the city is quite has a difficult position because its traditions and its inherited practices are all outwardly focused, internationally orientated. But the post-war Labour government, like most governments around the developed world in this period, and even in other non-developed places, thinking about Latin America, are really focused on domestic industrial development. And the city is sort of in a sort of awkward position in the 1940s. And this really only gets worse for it throughout the 1950s and into the 1960s, where this focus on industrial modernization and expansion becomes really the central aim of the British state for parties on the left and the right. And increasingly, the city's what role the city still has on an international level, which is attached to the use of the pound as a currency amongst as a trading currency for a large number of countries in what's known as the sterling era, increasingly comes to be criticized and challenged. And it really looks like in the sort of age of social democracy, the city is seen as holding back industrial modernization and development.
That serves as what I thought was one of the most fascinating aspects of your book, was this undercurrent theme of how you had these officials, these members of various governments, both conservative, but especially Labour, who thought of the economy in primarily an industrial context. You did have people who were familiar with finance, going back to, say, Stafford Cripps in the 45 government, but it seems as though they were always thinking of the economy in terms of industry first. And in 1945, that reflected where the focus of Britain's productive activity was. But as you describe the evolution of the economy in the 50s, in the 60s, into the 70s, especially in the 1970s, where you see this shift away from the industrial basis of the economy to more of a service basis really take place, that they're functioning with this older mentality that it's all about industry, and that finance is this aspect that they need to bring into line and not something that is emerging to become a dominant force in its own right.
Yeah, I think you have to understand that industry provides employment, stable quality employment to more people than financial services ever can. It also is seen as being the source of greatest productivity gains, of modernization, of if you think about it, it's not inaccurate to see that industrial modernization as the route to national prosperity. And think about the huge growth in car use and all sorts of home appliances and whatever. You know, these really are these manufactured products really are seen as the way forward for the national economy. So I would say that the way I characterize the post-war economic policy in Britain is of one of state intervention, not in a planned, directly controlled way. It's not like that, but it's about using the state to try and encourage and develop a modern and industrial economy, because that was seen as the way to achieve prosperity across the whole nation, I think. But also, you have to understand that I'd say that this national economic strategy was formed during the 1940s, when you have a Labour government that is, you know, representing workers, and workers need work. But also, you need to understand it in the context of Britain has this, after the war, has this terrible problem, which it basically can't afford to pay for its imports. It has this huge problem with its balance of payments. So it has to find some way to export export enough to pay its way in the world. And so that's why the post-war British state sort of settles on this sort of interventionist industrial development strategy.
As you describe early in the book, they are also concerned not just with paying Britain's way in the world, but finding the resources to modernize and develop Britain's industrial base. And you begin with this focus upon institutional investment. I was wondering if you'd explain what institutional investment is, what institutions were there, and how various governments sought to harness that investment to achieving those industrial aims.
Yeah, of course. So throughout the post-war period, more and more individuals, workers, are enrolled in pension schemes. And those pension schemes, you know, workers and their employers contribute a percentage of the wages of those workers and employees to a fund which is invested in the stock exchange and in other sort of assets. And over the course of this is a hugely significant and novel development in the post-war period. It takes place, the really rapid growth is in the 1950s and 1960s, where you've got the emergence of these huge funds of workers' accumulated savings that need to be invested. And it's not just pension funds, of course, there's also insurance companies also, so life insurance, things like that. So you've got these big agglomerations of investment capital that has never really, it's completely new. If you go back to before the war and earlier, most investment was by individuals, rich individuals. So this very significant development, the growth of sort of institutional investment occurs in the 1950s and 1960s, but actually occurs outside of political debate. Really, it's very interesting that nobody really notices it's happening. It's sort of a sort of quiet revolution. But by the time you get to the 1970s, Britain's facing a very severe industrial crisis. It's very severe. Like most of the rest of the industrial world, but it's particularly bad in Britain. And suddenly there is a need for a more radical approach to trying to not just develop the industrial economy, but now save it. Britain's saving Britain's industrial economy. And so figures on the left of the Labour Party and in the trade union movement, argue that these huge collections of funds, collections of savings in pension funds and insurance funds, really offer an opportunity to channel investment into areas that can be areas of the industrial economy that can provide future growth and prosperity. So you get this sort of very radical new approach to to investment policy, which is not really evident throughout the 50s and 1960s. Now, ultimately, it doesn't really go anywhere. Unfortunately for the people who are advocating it, though it continues to be advocated right through in the 1980s by the Labour Party. So some figures in the Labour Party and on the left think that you should entirely take over these funds and invest them directly. But for the most part, the idea is to find some way of coordinating the investment interests of those funds with the investing needs of the economy overall. So it's a revolution in Britain's financial scene that goes unnoticed until the crisis of the 1970s. And then there's some effort to sort of save Britain's very severely ailing industrial economy with these funds.
It reminds me in some way of the institutional activism that you see today, which is this idea of this recognition that these funds exert so much influence by virtue of their ownership of assets that there's the people invariably ask the question, well, perhaps we can use that influence to push things in a certain direction. And what you're describing here, though, is not so much the internal aspect of it, but this external perspective of these very important politicians and other leading figures saying, well, we have all this capital here. Why can't we possibly use it? Which then raises the question, why didn't the institutions themselves, why weren't they investing in British industry? And why ultimately did these efforts come up short?
Well, I think you have this argument over what is the duty of the institution. The representatives of the funds and the insurance companies argued that they had one simple duty, and that was to the person who'd put the money in the fund. And it was right for them to do anything other than to invest in what they thought were appropriate areas. Now, the criticism was that they were investing in these sort of short-term areas. So you get scandals over the investment in art, for example, by the National Coal Board's investment pension fund, and you get scandals over investing in property, which is very profitable, but is really, you know, not using the assets of the national community as they're sort of conceptualized very effectively. And actually, in the short term, it might be good for the argument is made against the institutions. In the short term, it might be perfectly good for your fund to invest in this property. But what good does it do if, in the long term, Britain is in, you know, severe long-term national economic decline? Because it's such an embedded idea in the post-war period, particularly on the left, though not entirely on the left, that the only route to prosperity is industrial expansion, and the only way to achieve that is through investment, more investment. So it's very interesting. I've been looking at this a bit further, and there's another tension in it, which is that the trade unions want to sort of organize investment on a national scale to help industry overall. Thinking about national industrial revitalization. But at the same time, they're also asking that the individual contributors to each fund are given a greater direct control over the assets that they own through their trade union. So you have a tension between local control over these funds, which is similar to the kind of activism you describe, versus a desire to use the nation, the state, the institutions of centralism, of the center to direct national resources. So it's a very interesting tension.
It's also interesting in that you have these institutional investors who, the very fact that they haven't been investing in British industry in itself does seem to be a damning judgment of their sense of the profitability of British industry in the post-war era, that they just don't see it as profitable as you explained, you know, purchasing property or even buying a Gainsborough or something.
Yeah, and that's the argument they make, really, which is to say, frankly, we don't turn down profitable opportunities. And if there were profitable opportunities in British industry, we would invest in it. And I suppose the counter argument from the left would be to say, well, your version of profitability is very short term. actually long-term profitability comes through long-term patient investment in the industries of the future, things like that. And the institutions are very reluctant to move beyond what is quite a rigid investment strategy, approach to investment. And I think we have to try and understand both sides here, you know, particularly the institutions as well, because I think they do have an obligation to their fund members. And I think the most interesting figure in this debate is Harold Wilson. So Harold Wilson was the Prime Minister of the UK in the late 60s, actually 1964 through until 1970, and then again 1974 to 76. And after he retires, he's appointed by the then Prime Minister, Jim Callaghan, to undertake an inquiry into the city, into Britain's financial system. Now, Wilson's not really a very radical figure. Well, he's certainly not a radical figure. But he does come around to seeing the argument that these huge funds have a huge amount of power and there's a huge amount of potential, and they needed to be directed in a more efficient and more and in a way that is beneficial to the long-term development of the British economy. But at the same time, he really does see also that they simply have these funds have an obligation to the people who put the money in them, and it's you can't just commandeer these funds in order to fulfill some sort of national interest, because they really are they are the contributions of not wealthy individuals, you know, just everyday working people. And so what Wilson, working with the trade union representatives on his inquiry, tries to do is find a way to sort of solve this, and he proposes creating a fund into which a proportion of these institutions' funds would be channeled, not all of them, just a proportion, and that fund would then be used, would then be invested in accordance with a strategy developed by the state, by trade unions, by businesses, for the long term, and to secure those contributions of the individuals. Promises the proposal is to ensure that they would receive at least a minimum return, so that no one's sort of money was no one's savings would be at risk. Now, this idea is resisted still by the financial sector, which still argued that, you know, it's really an issue of profitability, and it's not that actually industry is not struggling for investment was what they argued. But ultimately it goes nowhere, because in 1979 Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government is elected, and that sort of argument in favour of state intervention for the sake of national economic development really is not popular.
As you explain, the idea of that central fund is not the only idea being bandied about for greater direction over investment. You also explain the growing proposals in the 1970s to nationalize British banks. And here, I think it helps to explain a bit that the Bank of England had itself been a semi-private entity till 1945, and it was nationalized by the Labour government. But now, what's being discussed in the 1970s, especially on the Labour left, as you explain, is not just the Bank of England now, but the entire banking sector, or at least a significant chunk of it, to achieve, to achieve that goal of being able to direct investment towards British industry.
Yeah, so if you go back to the 1930s, the interwar period in general, the Labour Party is quite keen on nationalising, so taking public ownership, taking state control over the banking system, with the aim being to direct credit to those parts of the economy that needed it. But by the time you get to the end of the Second World War, this idea is dropped, largely because it's politically is politically very unpopular, but also because there's a greater faith that actually credit, you know, and credit and investment could be more effectively directed according to demand management. So the ideas of Keynes and others. So what happens is that the Bank of England is nationalised. It's a strange sort of nationalisation in that it keeps a lot of it keeps a huge amount of its independence, but on the key issue of interest rates, so the basic interest rate that the Bank of England will lend other banks to, which has an effect on the whole economy, that shifts to the government, the Treasury, which can decide, which is the Chancellor is then able to decide how the price of credit in the economy. So throughout the 1950s and 1960s, this settlement operates without much criticism from the left. So the demands for nationalisation disappear. But with the crisis of the 1970s, there's a greater pressure on the left for the state to take basically direct control again of the banks. Now, we need to be careful in saying that these ideas were very, very popular in the Labour Party, but probably very unlikely to be implemented, because the sort of the elite of the Labour Party, the governing elite of the Labour Party, the people in the positions of power, didn't want to do it, frankly, because it was hugely unpopular, and also because they doubted it would be that useful anyway. But there are figures on the Labour Party left who campaigned very vigorously in the 1970s to nationalise the whole banking system. And this is largely to do with this sort of what's deemed to have been the inadequacy of post-war social democratic economic policy, but also due to the fact that the banking system is not just seen as being poor in terms of providing credit, but increasingly the left criticizes it because it's just poor in providing commercial services to the public. You know, you've got five main banks basically, and they don't compete, barely compete at all. And when they are forced to compete in the 1970s, it leads to a massive crisis where all the banks put all their money in risky property lending, which leads to a crisis. So there's this sense that it has the way the banking sector has been controlled in the post-war period has been inadequate. When they tried to make it compete in the 1970s, the Conservative government, it failed. So we might as well just take control of it and direct credit to those parts of the economy that need it most.
I found it to be a very fascinating episode for two reasons. One was that it really does highlight the growing awareness, especially within the Labour Party, which was the party that essentially defined social democracy in post-war Britain immediately after the war, they're becoming increasingly aware of that the economy's changing, and that if they don't adapt, then their vision of social democracy is in jeopardy. But it's also fascinating because, as you explain in the chapter, and here's where you go beyond the government sources and look at the private records, the financial industry is becoming more active in terms of trying to shape policy, not just in a defensive way, but they're also beginning to appreciate their growing prominence, and they're beginning to try to have a greater say in not just the direction of their own finances and what they do with the monies under their control, but also beginning to ward off these interventions and assert greater control over greater influence in British politics.
Yes, I think so. So one thing that it does, this external threat to various aspects of the financial sector. And remember that we talk about the city, but it's made up of lots of different interest groups, of different investors, different types of banks, all these different people. But what it does do is encourage them to take a more become more active in politics in the 1970s in simply to defend their interests, because As much as I say I don't think it was likely that the banks were ever going to be fully nationalized, I find that unconvincing. They never knew. They didn't know that, and it could have quite easily been different. And the more radical wing of the Labour Party might have gained more prominence. So they took on a much more active engagement with politics. So traditionally, for example, we take the main banks, the kind of banks that you go to on the high street, or, you know, on the street, in America you say Main Street, and deposit your money in and, you know, get a card from and use it to spend in the shops. They traditionally, in the post-war decades, the 50s and 60s, stayed out of political debate and really engaged only with the state through the Bank of England. The Bank of England was their sort of the conduit for them to talk to government. But by the 1970s, as finance becomes politicized again, the financial sector starts to engage directly. So I spoke earlier about Harold Wilson creating a committee. Well, the big banks and their organization, their committee of London Clearing Bankers, which is the name that they use themselves, Clearing Bankers, they produced this lavish report demonstrating challenging the argument that the banks had failed British industry and failed the British public, and aren't making a counter argument instead that really the problem with Britain was that the British economy was that levels of profitability were low, and inflation was really the key issue, and government intervention was the big problem. So they became much more active political actors in the 1970s as a result of the threat to their continued existence.
It's not just a matter, though, of political engagement. It's also this fascinating public engagement. You reproduce this advertisement on opposite page 168, it's on page 169, in which you have this ad that was in the Times in 1968, in which they're playing up this this concept of invisible exports. They're making the case that, you know, we have industry, we send things across the world, but what we do finance, it may not be something you could package in a crate and put aboard a ship and send abroad, but it is just as important and needs to be respected as such. You're starting to see this growing flexing of their sense of self and their importance at a time when, as you've explained already in previous chapters, you still have policymakers in both parties still very much focused upon this idea of industry. They're not even thinking in terms of invisible exports, yet already you're starting to see these financial lobbyists, promoters, what have you, beginning to play up that concept that this is what the British economy, you know, that this is important to the British economy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the criticism made of the financial sector, so if we take the institutions, is that they don't invest properly in British industry. They're short-termist. The criticism of the banks was that they didn't invest properly, they didn't extend credit to British industry, and that was hampering the prospect for industrial development. But another criticism, which I sort of briefly mentioned at the start, was that the city, particularly in the 1960s, was hanging on to a sort of international role, which was a sort of hangover from Britain's age of dominance, right? It's global dominance. That the city was more interested in trying to get back to in looking abroad and operating as an international financial center, based on the use of the pound sterling as an international currency. Now, in the 1950s and 1960s, this became criticized quite heavily, not by radical figures on the left. This was quite a mainstream criticism that really this holding on to sterling as an international currency is really a policy that only benefits the city. And frankly, we need to move on and think much more about industrial exports, industrial modernization and development. The problem being that the maintenance of a high sterling exchange rate is just deemed to be bad for British industry, and also imposes sort of what they call stop grow growth on the British economy. So even before the 1970s, the city, particularly its international activities, which have been already very, very much constrained compared to what they would have been at the end of the 1914, the city is city's international activities are under threat. So what one of the chapters in the book looks at is the formation of something called the Committee on Invisible Exports. And this is led by a man who's actually a journalist, one of the lead main writers, financial writers for the Times newspaper. And he realizes that the city, for its international role to continue and be revived, as it had, you know, looking back to the end of the 19th century, had to make a new argument for itself, a new justification for itself. It couldn't just rely on old assumptions. And so what Clark did is he revived this concept of invisible exports, which you mentioned, which he doesn't invent. It's an old idea. But an invisible export is, if you sell a car abroad, you can see the car. But if you sell insurance or banking services to someone in another country, you can't see that, but it does earn income for the British economy. Clark argued was to say that actually, all this time British policymakers are obsessing about industry, but really we're quite good at selling services to foreigners. And what this argument does is it sort of it challenges the the consensual assumption about what the British economy is in the 1960s and in the 1970s. The consensus is Britain is an industrial economy. It's the first industrial economy. It's the economy of it is where the industrial revolution took place, and that is sort of embedded in post-war social democratic economic policy. But what Clark argues is to say, no, Britain is not primarily an industrial country. It is a financial and its strengths lie in financial and commercial services, in global trade, in being part of the global trading network, providing those sorts of services. And I think this is really interesting because I think it's a preamble to the reformation of Britain's national economic strategy from the late 1970s onwards, away from an intense focus on developing in industry for export and towards a new understanding of the British economy, which says that Britain is a financial commercial service provider. And that legitimates the revival and, frankly, the huge growth in the City of London as an international financial centre in the latter decades of the 20th century.
I like how you frame the shift away from Keynesian fiscal focus of economic management that you'd seen after 1945 to monetarism, which characterized the neoliberal Thatcherite movement in the 1980s in this context. That in a sense, it's almost as if the government is saying not just the governments, but the British state is saying, okay, from now on, we have to think what benefits finance and the ability of finance to expand and prosper instead of just predominantly industry.
Yeah, so I would say that the final chapter in the book, which looks at monetarism, perhaps doesn't explicitly set out to do that, because the industrial focus of British economic policy is not does not get displaced until, I mean, I'm not really sure actually, but fully displaced until later in the 1980s. On the chapter on monetarism, I'm very interested in, I came to write this chapter because the traditional story we have about monetarism, right, is an idea developed by Milton Friedman, and he said that inflation is caused by too much money being produced, and so you have to control the supply of the amount of money in the economy, and the government is in a position to do this, and therefore inflation will go away. And it's a very idealistic account. But at the same time, when I was researching, I saw that there was a lot of arguments were made, like much like what you just said a moment ago, that the monetarist strategy, which involved increasing interest rates very highly to control inflation and cutting back on public expenditure, was simply the expression of the priorities of the city, of the financial sector. And I thought that was very interesting because that sort of largely been ignored, I think, in writing about the sort of shift from Keynesian demand management to monetarism, or the monetarist experiment in the early 80s. And so what I try to show in the chapter is that it revolves around the issue of public debt, really. And I try to show how the various investors in the financial in the market, London markets, who would buy British government debt, came to be influenced by monetarist ideas in the 1970s, and in coming to be influenced by monetarist ideas, changed their investment behavior, and in changing their investment behavior, created new pressures and demands on the economic policy of the British state. So, in a sense, the monetarism, I think, in the chapter, I argue, is a capitulation to the demands of finance, or the government, those who would buy the government's debt at a point where the government needs to is borrowing very heavily, but not necessarily coherent or planned or deliberate, but a sort of complex interaction between ideas and self-interest and sort of the institutions of the market institutions for selling government debt. I try to show how this sort of frankly messy process takes place.
By the time you get to the end of your book, then, we've seen this dramatic transformation take place in the British economy. And in this transformation, the process has really done a lot to undermine a lot of the assumptions on which the social democratic vision of post-war Britain that was articulated in the 1940s had come to be based.
Yeah, absolutely. So the post-war material conditions of post-war social democracy have disappeared. And I think we should see the 1970s, particularly that when I spoke about institutional investment and even the attempt to nationalize the banks, perhaps but blunt an idea as it was an attempt to reformulate that post-war social democracy. That social democracy it was an attempt to adapt social democracy to new material conditions, ultimately failed. Now, social democracy readapted itself in the 1990s in a very different way, in a way that was much more, much less resistant to those material changes, and went much more with the grain. Particularly of a large financial sector, internationally orientated financial sector in London. So the new Labour governments that were elected after 1997 are very strong supporters of global financial, the City of London as a global financial sector for various reasons, largely because the alternative national economic growth model of developing an industrial economy is seen as no longer particularly viable because large amounts of industry have disappeared, and types of industry that employ large amounts of people have disappeared. So that's, Britain is left with a large financial sector that brings in foreign income and tax revenues, and so social democracy adapts to the city in very different ways after. Was it 18 years of conservative government? Britain's political economy is very significantly remade in the 80s and the 1990s. And I suppose in the book, this book, I like to think of as a sort of preamble to part of that, to try and put what happens in the 1980s and the 1990s in a context that doesn't simply say, well, this was due to Margaret Thatcher and her governments, who are influenced by what we might call neoliberal ideas or market liberal ideas. These had long-term roots in the post-war decades.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now? You've already explained that you're going to be pursuing some of these projects. Are you thinking in terms of a second book, or are you thinking in terms of multiple books or articles?
Yeah, so I was very fortunate after finishing my PhD to get a position at the University of Bristol as a postdoctoral researcher working on a book with Hugh Pemberton and James Freeman, who are at the University of Bristol. And Hugh was an expert on the history of pensions. And so what we've written about is we've written a book on the Thatcher government's attempt to reform the pensions. So that follows directly on from what we're talking about with the institutional investors. In the 1980s, the real threat to the institutions doesn't come from the left, it comes from the right. And the Thatcher government sets out to destroy all the institutions. And instead of have these collective pools of workers' savings being invested in British industry or around the world, they try to individualize everyone's pension. So it's a nice follow-on. And now that that book is currently being written up, and my next project is to think about the successor to that Committee on Invisible Exports I spoke about, which continues to this day, actually. It's developed and it now operates as the city's main lobbying body. It's called the City UK. But one of its really important subcommittees is called something called the Liberalisation of Trade in Services Committee. And this is a committee that campaigned for the breakdown of all barriers to the trade in financial and commercial services around the world in the 80s and the 90s. And I want to look at how that committee has shaped Britain's national economic approach to international economic trading arrangements, and what influence it had over the creation of global finance at the end of the 20th century.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating project. Alan Davies, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks very much, Mark. Bye-bye.